Okay, we're at Matthew chapter 8 here on Wednesday nights. That this Gospel of Matthew, this is the first chapter where Christ is really portrayed as interacting with other people. He's been pretty isolated up to this point. The first few chapters are accounts of his early life. Then there's the Sermon on the Mount, which is rather long. And yes, he's talking to other people during the entire three chapters of the Sermon on the Mount. But he doesn't really start to interact with others until the very end of chapter 7. So this is the rubber to the road part of his gospel in as far as Matthew's concerned, when he's actually interacting with crowds and teaching them and what we see how he interacts with people. That's all I can say about Matthew chapter 8 right now. So you're welcome to read what you want, or as much as you want. I'd rather go at a decent pace.
Yeah. And upon his descending from the mountain, many crowds followed him. And behold, a leper coming forth worshipped him, saying, "Prince, if you wish, you are able to cleanse me." And extending his hand, he touched him, saying, "I wish, be cleansed." And immediately his leprosy had been cleansed. And Yahshua says to him, "See that you speak to no one, but go show yourself in the temple and offer the gift which Moses prescribed for a testimony to them." And upon his coming into Capernaum, a centurion came forth to him, summoning him and saying, "Prince, my servant is a paralytic, stricken in the house, being tormented terribly." And he says to him, "I coming shall heal him." But responding, the centurion said, "Prince, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only say a word and my servant shall be healed. For I also am a man appointed by authority, having under myself soldiers, and I say to this one, 'Go,' and he goes, and to another one, 'Come,' and he comes, and to my servant, 'Do this,' and he does it." And hearing, Yahshua marveled and said to those following, "Truly I say to you, from no one in Israel have I found such faith. I say to you that many shall come from east and west, and they shall recline with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of the heavens. But the sons of the kingdom shall be cast out into the outermost darkness, and there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth." And Yahshua said to the centurion, "Go, as you have believed, it must be for you." And the servant was healed that hour. Had to scroll down, Bill.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's okay.
But yeah,
this is a good place to take a pause, perhaps. The sacrifice for leprosy in Leviticus chapter 14, it's described that two birds are taken, and one of them sacrificed by the priest, and the other one, if he is healed of his leprosy, the second bird is let go. Is let freed again in an open field. I don't think I have to elaborate that on that much more, but I'm pretty sure that's what Christ is referring to there, that he brings two birds to the temple, and the priest, seeing that he's healed of his leprosy, would have to let one go and sacrifice the other.
That would have never happened before, though, would it, Bill? Because the priest couldn't heal leprosy, so it would have been a sign to them that he was the Messiah, wouldn't it?
Well, yes, that would have definitely been a sign.
Actually, wasn't there one king who was healed by Yahweh? Oh, sorry.
Evidently,
Bill.
There are men that, I mean, the law explains or anticipates that a priest could heal leprosy. I don't know if it's ever been done. I don't know if it's stated that it's never been done.
Yeah, I think maybe one king was healed, but I don't think the priest could generally heal leprosy. So if someone comes healed from leprosy, then it's a miracle.
Yes, it's definitely a miracle. Was there a king healed of leprosy? I don't know if that's true. I remember one king with leprosy, but I'm sorry, it's escaped me whether or not he was healed.
Wait, yeah, no, he died with it then. Yeah, maybe he wasn't healed. I'm remembering it wrong. So there you go. So no one except this man up till this time actually fulfilled that part of the law, because no one could heal leprosy. That's what I think anyways.
I would have to look. This Naaman the prophet, Naaman the Syrian, was healed of his leprosy, I believe.
Right. And that was in the time of Elisha.
Yes. Naaman the Syrian, one time Christ mentions that here in the gospel. Didn't he mention Naaman here? Or he does mention it in the gospel in a similar context.
But even in that situation, Elisha sends him to the river to do it, right? So he didn't directly lay hands on him or anything like that.
Right.
Well, right, but I'm sure lepers were hanging around rivers all the time and never got healed.
That's fair.
In Numbers, in Leviticus chapter 14, it sort of insinuates that it can happen, and the priest shall go forth out of the camp, and the priest shall look and behold, if the plague of leprosy be healed in the leper. Okay, let me start sooner. I'm sorry. And Yahweh spoke unto Moses, saying, this shall be the law of the leper in the day of his cleansing. He shall be brought unto the priest. So that's when he's already cleansed. In the day of his cleansing, he shall be brought unto the priest. And the priest shall go forth out of the camp, and the priest shall look and behold, if the plague of leprosy be healed in the leper. Then shall the priest command to take for him, that is to be cleansed, two birds alive and clean, and cedar wood and scarlet and hyssop, and the priest shall command that one of the birds be killed in an earthen vessel over running water. As for the living bird, he shall take it, and the cedar wood and the scarlet and the hyssop, and shall dip them and the living bird in the blood of the bird that was killed over the running water. And he shall sprinkle upon him that is to be cleansed from the leprosy seven times, and shall pronounce him clean, shall let the living bird loose into the open field. So there you have it. It's a ritual, but evidently that's of a person that has already apparently been cleansed of leprosy. So the priest actually wasn't doing the cleansing. So this man would have been expected to take those two birds to the temple so that the priest can do that ritual if he appears to be cleaned of his leprosy. Which is more like a public pronouncement that that a leper's been cleansed, which was probably and certainly a very rare occasion. So yes, it would be considered a miracle.
Seems almost like it'd be like a public service announcement, also sort of thing. Like I'm cleansed of leprosy.
Right. I would agree with that. It's a sort of weird ritual, but I would agree with that. This, the Universalists love this passage. Truly I say to you, no one in Israel have I found such faith. And that was because of this Roman centurion that came to him asking that his servant be healed of paralysis. Well, that doesn't mean that this Roman is not an Israelite from ancient times, but nobody knew that he was of Israel. Nobody at this time, none of these people at this time hearing Christ, it would not have been evident to them that he was an Israelite of some long lost dispersion. So he would have appeared to them not to be an Israelite. No one of Israel have I found. And he's not meaning that the man isn't a descendant of Abraham or Isaac from 1,200 years before this, but it wasn't apparent that he was an Israelite. The children of Israel were still to be blind to their identity, to who they were. So it wasn't to be revealed in that time. It simply wasn't. even though Paul began to reveal it later, but nobody got it because it really still wasn't supposed to be revealed. It's right in front of us in black and white, but it's not publicly known to this day. Except by a bunch of identity Christians who were considered to be nuts in the eye of the lunatics in the eyes of the rest of the world.
Where are they here? Are they in Galilee? Where is Christ?
Capernaum. Capernaum's in Galilee. It's on the Sea of Kinnereth. And it's called the Sea of Galilee, which is a misnomer.
Okay. I just think that's important too, Ben, you know, that he mentioned Israel specifically in there in Galilee. But Galilee was old, the kingdom of Israel, wasn't it? Part of it?
It's complicated.
Yeah, no, I understand.
Galilee was part of the ancient kingdom of Israel, yes.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I understand it's complicated.
But at this time, Galilee was actually under the control of Herod Antipas. And that's evident later when Pilate sends Christ to Herod Antipas to be judged, and Herod Antipas doesn't want anything to do with him because he was a Galilean. Christ was from Galilee, from Nazareth.
Yes.
That's why Pilate sent him to Herod Antipas. I'm sorry?
He was never a Judean, which is another argument that you get a lot, especially from kikes.
Yeah, but that's also a
shallow
argument. It's a shallow argument, taking advantage of the microcosm of politics at the time, which is basically what I'm trying to describe. The Judah was still considered part of Judea, but it was part of a tetrarchy and not ruled over by Pilate directly. The sons of the first Herod, they actually, and after Herod Archelaus, who was his oldest son, I believe, his oldest living son, was banished by Rome because he was such a screw up. Others of Herod's sons received portions of his kingdom. And it wasn't reunited again until 41 AD, and it was only united for 3 years, and then it was split up again. That was with the death of Herod Agrippa I in Acts chapter 12. He was the only one of Herod's successors that was actually king over Herod's whole kingdom, but only for 3 years. He was one of the tetrarchs before that. And Herod Antipas was another, and there were two others. The other one was, I'm trying to remember his name, and I can't right now, but he was the brother of Herod Antipas that had married his daughter. He took Herod's daughter to wife, or Herod took his daughter to wife, or something like that, and also took his ex-wife to wife. That they were all marrying their own daughters and sisters and cousins. So he was the one that was condemned by John the Baptist for doing that. But they were all sons of the first Herod.
They do the same thing today.
Yeah, they do. The Rothschilds, look at them, right? They were all marrying their first cousins.
Yeah, and even nieces. What I understand.
Philip the Tetrarch, that was him. That was his name. Herod Antipas, Philip the Tetrarch, he had the quarter that was in the northeast. And Herod Antipas had the northwest, which is Galilee.
Didn't the Romans take power away from Philip the Tetrarch?
I think eventually they did. They've given it all to they took power away from both of them, or maybe it was upon their deaths, I'm not sure. But Agrippa I ended up with the whole kingdom again in 41 AD. So he replaced Herod Antipas and Philip the Tetrarch. And whoever Pilate's successor was. Because Pilate was the proconsul. You don't need that office if there's a kingdom. Pilate was there ruling Jerusalem in the interest of Rome because there was no kingdom. Once the king's appointed, the Romans would withdraw their governors in favor of the king.
You mentioned verse 10.
Well, we're probably getting off the track. I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead, Joe. I didn't mean to send y'all on a tangent.
You didn't. No, it's relevant. You mentioned verse 10 before, Bill, you know, the faithful Roman centurion. And he says, "Truly I say to you, from no one in Israel have I found such faith." In the very next verse, it's almost like Christ is revealing part of the mystery, but he doesn't reveal it all. He says in verse 11, "I say to you that many shall come from east and west, and they shall recline with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of the heavens." So why are they reclining with Abraham, Isaac, and why are they being gathered from the east and the west? That's a prophecy that God would gather Israel, the outcast of Israel, from east and west to recline with Abraham, their father. Like, that's why they're reclining with Abraham. And so he says, "From no one in Israel have I found such faith." Well, this Roman is one of the outcast of Israel, so he's not actually considered part of Israel. But then in verse 11, this prophecy that Christ hints out, that refers to him because he's one of the outcasts from east and west. He, you know, he'll gather them to recline with Abraham. So it's like Christ is sort of speaking in riddles, and he's not revealing the full truth yet. And then in verse 12, he says, "But the sons of the kingdom," that's the kingdom that stands at the moment, it's not his kingdom, "they shall be cast out into outermost darkness." That's the princes of this world, because they control the kingdoms of this world. Satan took Christ up to that high mountain. He's looking over all the kingdoms of the world. Well, they're the sons of the kingdom. They're the princes of this world. They're the Edomites who took control. They're going to be cast out, and they're going to be weeping and gnashing their teeth, but we don't care. We're going to tread them down anyways. And then he says,
right, it's very clear in the rest of the gospel, in the balance of the gospels later in Matthew and throughout the gospel of John, that these Christ disowned these people, that these people running Jerusalem. But I was going to go there, Joe. It's Zechariah chapter 8, verse 7. "Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, behold, I will save my people from the east country. And will bring them, and they shall dwell in the midst of Jerusalem." And of course, that never happened yet up to the time of Christ, and it still hasn't happened. Some people would claim it's happened in these Jews, but no, he's saying that he many will come from the east and west. So they hadn't come yet. And there are similar prophecies throughout Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 43, "Fear not, for I am with thee. I will bring thy seed from the east and gather thee from the west. I will say to the north, give up, and to the south, keep not back. Bring my sons from afar and my daughters from the ends of the earth." That did not happen by the time of Christ. In the time of Christ, the Judeans were only descended from 42,000 people that came back from Babylon. And that's not a gathering from the east and the west and the north and the south. And that they had intermingled with all those Edomites in the first century BC, second century BC. So that doesn't fulfill these prophecies.
In that prophecy.
I'm sorry. No, I was going to just add found in Isaiah and Zechariah, right? But
yeah. Well, in that prophecy you mentioned, it says, "Gather my sons from afar and my daughters from the ends of the earth." Does that mean the daughters have gone further away than the sons?
No. That's just a Hebrew parallelism, that they've both gone pretty far.
All the girls are on the edge of flat earth, Joe. Yeah, everybody's trying to get there.
That's why it's made of an ice wall.
Yes.
to stop them going too far. They're limited. Unless they get a plane. If they get a plane, they can fly over the ice wall and hit the dome.
Do you really think a woman can fly a plane, Joe?
I don't know, man.
I was kind of joking. I was kind of trying to insinuate that it was an ice fall because the girls were there.
Yes.
I was being mean.
That is me. Yeah, now I get
so, yeah, that's why it's the Arctic. Or the Antarctic.
But behind the ice wall, you know, she's behind that little ice wall. She's really warm and kind, and that's why she has the ice wall, isn't it? So, all right, you want me to keep reading? I'll keep reading.
Yeah, I think we've discussed that enough, probably.
I'm sorry, ladies, and I'm sorry that got recorded.
I think it's good.
We have to be able to joke. Get around a little bit.
Keep them.
Otherwise,
we're
just
place.
Like they are in church. Screw that.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say I'm sarcastically misogynistic. Sorry to interrupt your reading.
Yeah, same. Like, I wear a wife beater every day.
I'm not sure.
Anyways, yeah, I'm being sarcastic. Anyways, verse 14. We're going to read from verse 14. Then Yahshua, coming into the house of Petros, saw his mother-in-law stricken and sick with fever, and he grasped her hand, and the fever left her, and she arose and served him. Then upon its getting late, they brought to him many who were possessed by demons, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all those having maladies, that the word would be fulfilled, which through the prophet Isaiah says, he has taken our weaknesses and bears our diseases. Then Yahshua, seeing a crowd around him, had commanded to depart for the other side. And one scribe coming forth said to him, Teacher, I shall follow you wherever you should depart. And Yahshua says to him, the foxes have dens and the birds of heaven nests, but the Son of Man has not where he may lay the head. Then another of the students said to him, Prince, allow me first to depart and bury my father. But Yahshua says to him, follow me and allow the dead to bury the dead for themselves. And with his boarding into a vessel, his students followed him. And behold, a great commotion happened on the sea, so for the vessel to be covered by the waves, but he slept. And coming forth, they roused him, saying, Prince, save us, we are being destroyed. And he says to him, what are you, cowards, you of little faith? Then arising, he censured the winds and the sea, and there came a great calm. Then the men marveled, saying, from whence is this man that even the winds and the sea obey him?
Okay, in the house of Peter. So Peter was married, and there's evidence of this elsewhere in the Gospels. Peter was married at this time, and he had a mother-in-law. And the house, which was probably the house of his mother-in-law, we're still in Galilee, unless Peter had care for his mother-in-law because she was a widow or something. That's another possibility. Paul of Tarsus later said that the other apostles, including Peter, had wives. I believe that's in 1 Corinthians.
Yeah.
He has taken our weaknesses and bears our diseases is a citation apparently from Isaiah chapter 53, verse 4. In the Septuagint, he bears our sins and his pain for us, yet we accounted him to be in trouble and suffering and in affliction. In the King James, surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. I'd have to compare the Hebrew and the Greek to account for the minor differences, but they're minor.
He also bears our sins. But isn't it interesting? It's interesting to me that at this time, they're all there's a lot of people who seem to be possessed by demons, and the kingdom's ruled by Edomites at this time. So it's almost like if you have a kingdom where it's ruled by devils, you're going to have a lot of demonic curses in that nation. You know what I mean? It's like before, when they had their own kingdom, there wasn't, the Old Testament doesn't talk so much about being possessed by demons or demonic influence so much. And then you get to this time where they're ruled by the Edomites, and suddenly there's a lot of people who are possessed by demons, just as they're possessed by these Edomite bastards.
Yeah, well, I would venture so far, and I'm really not that superstitious. I'm pretty pragmatic, but I would venture so far as to say that it's the same thing where you have a lot of blacks and Hispanics and other people that are demons themselves, and they seem to attract that same phenomena.
Curses.
Or perhaps there's a lot of schizophrenia in those groups as well. A lot of schizophrenia.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Yeah, it's like the Wigger walking up down the street acting like he's black, but he's a white man. And then, I mean, and that's the Edomite. Could you not consider that possession as well?
Sure. And then just the Jewish mind virus, which I'm sure they had some sort of, you know, way that they pushed their property. Well, the temple. I mean, you had to abide by the temple, I guess, back then.
Yeah, that is a kind of possession, like the mind virus. It's like you're possessed.
Right. And that's probably what Christ was doing. He was probably just trying to beat the nigger out of these people.
Well, there must have been a lot of disenchanted people for John the Baptist to have such a successful ministry at the rivers on the Sabbath days.
Yeah.
That tells me that the people weren't in the synagogues.
Yes.
Kind of like today.
The other thing, too, is in that passage that Joe just read, these people don't even know who Christ is yet. He's just healing people, and they like what he's saying so far. You know what I mean? And, right. And there's tons of people followed him around.
Yeah,
you know, Prince, followers. Allow me first to depart and to bury my father. I wouldn't take that too lightly. I mean, not too many of us have a chance to follow such a wonderful teacher who can obviously heal paralytics and lepers and things like that right in front of the crowds. I mean, without the Benny Hinn act going on. Well, it's a once in a lifetime opportunity. I wouldn't. For sure, yeah. I would say that the chances to do that sincerely and because you really have to do it and because you really should do it are very slim, right? I mean, once in a lifetime, not even. It's once in 100 lifetimes, for real.
But Jeff is right that they didn't really know who he was at this point, because even the men with him in the boat were like, from whence is this man that even the winds obey him?
Right. But I think this is representative of the fact that when it's time to follow God, we have to follow God and not even our own parents, right? Not even our own father. And he said that even before the winds obeyed him. So that's the only people that really saw the winds obey him are his 12 disciples, the ones that, well, maybe 11, the ones that stayed with him all this time. And actually, Matthew's not even with him yet at this time. So he doesn't have 12 yet at this time. There may have been others, though, in the group.
There were a few dozen, right?
Yeah, it may have been a larger group, but all 12 of those accounted apostles weren't here this time. Matthew appears in the next chapter. So Matthew has all these stories vicariously. These first 8 chapters, he did not witness he took them from collected accounts.
We're in a situation like this today where, you know, the sea of people, these non-whites, are like trying to destroy our vessel, or we're like Noah on the ark, you know, being preserved from the mixed multitudes, and the disciples are worried. They're like, oh no, we're going to be wiped out, you know, all these non-whites, the sea, it's going to destroy us. And Yahshua is like, well, if you're with me, what are you, cowards? You have little faith. You know, we should understand that God will preserve us like he preserved Noah. Or these disciples here. God is in control.
I think that was just another episode to make them realize who they were actually with, who they were following.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm just going meta level, Bill. It's meta, you know.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I mean, I understand that. That was fine. I do understand that.
All right. You want me to read the next bit?
And I would accept that. Yeah, go ahead.
All right. He heals two men with demons. And upon his coming to the other side of to the country of the Gadarenes, two men possessed by demons coming out from among the tombs met him, exceedingly troublesome, so that not anyone is able to pass by through that road. And behold, they cried out, saying, what is with us and with you, O Son of Yahweh? Have you come already to torment us prematurely? Now there was afar off from them a herd of many swine feeding, and the demons exhorted him, saying, if you cast us out, send us into the herd of swine. And he said to them, go. And they, coming out, departed into the swine, and behold, the whole herd rushed headlong down the bank into the sea and died in the water. And those feeding them fled, and coming into the city, reported everything, even the things concerning those possessed by demons. And behold, the whole city came out for a meeting with Yahshua, and seeing him, they exhorted that he would pass over from their districts. Did you get all that? Because my
we heard you.
Yeah, we heard you, Joe. You were fine. This Gadarenes, it's really problematical. It's in the Gospel of Mark in chapter 5. It's Gadarenes in the Codex Alexandrinus and the Codex Ephraemiceri. It's Gergestines in the Codex Washingtonensis, which is from the 5th century. It's Gergestanum, and I'm sorry, it's Gerasenes in the Codex Sinaiticus, the Codex Vaticanus, and the Codex Beze. So there's three different readings in Mark, and that's probably the best one in Mark, according to witnesses. So that's the one I have that I follow. But here in Matthew, the best one, according to the ancient manuscripts, the witnesses, is Gadarenes. So it can only be one or the other, but I don't know if we're ever going to know which one it is. I don't even know if it's that. It's evidently on the eastern seaboard of the Sea of Galilee somewhere. On the eastern shores. And I don't know if the place can even be pinpointed precisely. I've looked for it before in archaeological sources and Bible maps and things like that, but I could never get a satisfactory answer.
Mark Downey used to say that these two men had a mental illness and they weren't actually possessed by demons. But as he cast them out, he says, they coming out departed into the swine. So how can that be a mental illness? Like, how can a mental illness come out from a man?
Right. And go into a pig. It was contagious, I guess, like COVID.
And you know, these it was pigs, COVID. Like falling off a cliff.
Climate change.
Into, climate change. Into the sea. So it's exemplary of the Lake of Fire. They were going into their destiny.
Essentially. That's a great connection.
There's no doubt that one of the pigs was named Greta Thunberg.
Oh. She is a pig. Yeah, so the great grandma, it can't be a mental illness, because if you look at the great grandma, it's a demon coming out of the man. And you know, if don't eat swine, because swine, you know, demonic entities hang around unclean animals like swine. So here's another example where Judeo-Christians should read this and say, do I really want to eat pork? Because here, pork is not a good thing.
Oh. I know several otherwise rational people that they've had encounters with demons, but with sentient demons, I mean, they could think and do things for themselves or whatever. I've never had the experience, so, and these are rational people that I've known and met and spoke to, that I can't just tell them, look, dude, you're fucking nuts, get out of here. It's hard to do that, right?
Yeah.
What do you mean, Bill? That a Ouija board? It's,
and that would be awfully something, simply because I haven't personally experienced it. That's arrogance to me.
What they experienced, though, Bill? Like, how did they? What? How did they meet a demon or whatever? Like, how did that happen? A person was possessed.
There's several diverse accounts that I've heard. I don't really want to get into all the details here, but evidently there are otherworldly beings or spirit beings or whatever you want to call them that are demons that can find ways to interact with men. And that's what we have going on throughout the New Testament accounts. And Mark, he denied those accounts to a great point, because he wrote those things off to an illness and insisted on that. When very often, I mean, the demons are interacting as spirits possessing men, and they're interacting with men. So I wouldn't just dismiss them because I haven't experienced it.
I will say that I don't think now is the time to go into it, but I have seen something that could be perceived as a demon. I certainly 100% believe that they are legitimate.
And you know, when they come after you, Nick, is when you're weak, you know, weak in state.
Well, I in my past life, I had, you know, messed around with a bunch of really evil stuff, and that's when that stuff started to manifest.
Yep.
Ouija board, probably.
No, it wasn't Ouija board. I don't want to get into it, but just, you know, I could have been seeing things and all of that, but I am thoroughly convinced.
I've heard stories about Ouija boards and stuff, but that, anyways.
These here are described as sentient beings that could communicate and think for themselves, and they went into the swine. I don't think this was a couple of niggers that jumped into a herd of swine and drove them all down a cliff.
No. And Jesus,
I just can't see this like that.
Reverse swine.
I'm sorry.
And Jesus,
yeah, they are swine.
Pretending to cast out demons to because the crowd, you know, like I think Mark used to say, like, oh, the people at that time were falling for Greek paganism, so they believed in demons, and Jesus just went along with it. So he was pretending to cast out demons.
That's crazy. Who said that?
Mark, Jesus was pretending to cast out demons because the people at that time had fallen for Greek paganism and pagan concepts. And so the people in Israel at that time believed in demons because of paganism, and Jesus just went along with it.
So Mark Downey thinks Jesus is a Jew and has like a traveling carnival show.
Yeah, like, why would Jesus pretend and lie to people, sort of thing, is what I thought. I thought there's no way Jesus would pretend to cast out demons if they're not true, you know?
Well, I think that 33 and 34 verses, they kind of explain, in those days, people understood that these things were real, right? To us now, it's, you know, we're like kind of almost it's debating.
Hokey
like,
pokey, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, and it says, like, when they heard, right, and coming into the city reported everything, they came out, the whole damn town came out to see him because they're like, they know that these things exist, right? They had to experience it. At some point in their lives, they probably all did, right? We do too, but we just don't account it for that. And then they wanted him to leave, which I said last week, you know, and that's the thing is like, even though they're tormented, I mean, I shouldn't laugh. They're tormented by these things, these demons, but they still don't want the solution around, right?
Yeah. It's like if you took all the niggers away, there'd be people going, oh, no, you've taken the niggers away. We lived in a multicultural society.
Yeah, we need another boatload.
It's like, what were it's like I would be celebrating, and they just don't know. They just can't celebrate with me, sad.
Well, it's okay. It's just a matter of how much you actually recognize what is going on. You recognize what's really going on. When you recognize what's really going on, you'll celebrate. But these people didn't. They didn't really recognize it, although they dealt with it. That's how I look at it, anyhow.
They didn't want any trouble, basically. Imagine many of them thought Jesus was being a troublemaker doing that.
Yeah, and they were comfortable.
Well, Mark Downey refused to believe in any evil spirits and any devils, so to speak, and any he was probably way overboard pragmatic, so he tried to describe everything in worldly terms, even at the expense of Christ and the apostles.
Yeah.
When you demote Christ to the level of a Jewish showman, like you said, that's a horrible thing to do, man.
That kind of pissed me off, really, when I put it in that term, yeah.
We want to do the next chapter or what?
Yeah, even if we don't finish it, but we probably will.
All right. Well, I'm going to start reading it then.
Let's do it.
Matthew chapter 9. And having boarded into a vessel, he crossed over and had come to his own city. And behold, they brought to him a paralytic placed upon a cot. And Yahshua, seeing their faith, said to the paralytic, "Have courage, son, your errors are forgiven." And behold, some of the scribes said among themselves, "This man blasphemies." And Yahshua, seeing their consideration, said, "For what reason do you ponder evil in your hearts? For what is easier to say, 'Your sins are forgiven,' or to say, 'Arise and walk'? But in order that you would know that the Son of Man has authority upon the earth to forgive errors," then he says to the paralytic, "Arising, take your cot and go to your house." And arising, he departed for his house. Then seeing it, the crowds feared and honored Yahweh for giving such authority to men. Yeah. And Yahshua,
at that point, you just say, "I'm sorry, dude. I'm sorry."
Well, yeah, this shows that Christ had the authority to forgive sins on earth, which means it's his law and he's the judge of the law. It shows that he's God on earth.
Right.
Do you want to say anything else about that paragraph, Bill?
No, not really, but even the crowd honored Yahweh for giving such authority to men. They didn't know, that's their perspective, right? That's their perspective. They didn't know that he was God on earth.
And Yahshua,
go on.
All right. And Yahshua, passing from there, sees a man sitting at the tax office called Matthias, and says to him, "Follow me." And arising, he followed him. And it happened upon his reclining in the house, then behold, many tax collectors and wrongdoers having come reclined with Yahshua and his students. And the Pharisee, seeing, said to his students, "For what reason does your teacher eat with tax collectors and wrongdoers?" But he hearing said, "Those who are strong have no need of a physician, but those who have maladies. Now going, you learn why it is mercy I desire, not sacrifice. For I have not come to call the righteous, but the wrongdoers." Then the students of Ioni, John, came forth to him, saying, "For what reason do we and the Pharisees fast, but your students do not fast?" And Yahshua said to them, "The sons of the bride chamber are not able to hunger for as long as the bridegroom is with them, but the day shall come when the bridegroom has been taken from them, and then they shall fast. Now no one puts a patch of uncarded cloth upon an old garment, for it lifts its borders away from the garment, and it becomes torn worse. Nor do they put new wine into old skins, but if it is, the skins break, and the wine pours out, and the skins are destroyed. Rather, they put new wine into new skins, and both are kept together."
That name is, that's actually a Hebrew name, which was transliterated into Greek as Ioannis. And it's my opinion that the Hebrews pronounced it very much like the Germans do today, like Johann, Johannes. But it's John. In English, it's John.
Yeah, I only speak English.
Yeah, Matthias is Matthew, the author of this gospel. And evidently, Matthew got invited to follow Christ, and he did, of course, because that's why we have this gospel. But he also brought along his tax collectors, and they came in to dinner with the other apostles, right? That's what appears to be going on here to me. That Matthew probably turned to a few of his fellow tax collectors and say, "Come on, we're going to go with this guy and go eat with it at his house or something." That's my opinion of what's going on here.
How many of them were kikes, do you think?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to tell, but perhaps none of them were, if he just brought a couple of his fellow workers or friends.
I'm just, what stands out to me is how little people seem to know the scriptures at this time when Christ is around them. Like, they don't seem to have any idea who he is or.
Right. But they were probably collecting taxes at this time for the Romans.
Yes.
And not for the Judeans.
Yeah. And they probably had a guilty conscience, right? So they looked for the first opportunity to try to alleviate that.
It was just kind of a hypothetical for me, because I figure it was probably, even Matthew at that time was probably like multicultural global homo, probably before he started off with Christ, right? He was young too, wasn't he? Like 20 or something?
I don't know if we could really know how old Matthew was. I'm being honest.
Okay. I don't know why I feel, I must have read somewhere that he was 20, but I don't really have any evidence of that or anything.
Sometimes I suspect that he's of the tribe of Levi. He's a Levite, not only because of this reference here, but I thought he was connected to someone named Levi in one of the Gospels. I might be.
And tax, I mean, we get the term levy taxes from the Levites, right?
Yeah, in Mark, he's called Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at the receipt of custom, and said unto him, "Follow me." So Mark called him Levi.
Okay.
Levi became the name Lewis in modern times, actually.
Yeah.
I love the bit how...
In Luke chapter 3, though, there's, in the genealogy of Christ, there's a Matthat, the son of Levi, too. So those names are popular, evidently. But in Luke chapter 5, and after these things went forth and saw a publican named Levi sitting at the receipt of custom, and he said unto him, "Follow me." So Matthew, Luke and Mark both call Matthew Levi. So I always thought he might have been a Levite and not a Benjaminite or a Galilean for that reason. I mean, that could be wrong. That's just a whim, or it's just a, you just wonder about that. I'm just wondering about it.
Well, there's two witnesses right there, though, right?
Yeah, but that doesn't, he could have had a second name, Levi, but it seems to me that he may have been in a tribe of Levi, not only for having that name, but also for having that vocation, because right. That was something that in the old kingdom, the Levites would have done.
Yeah, they were tax collectors and arbiters of the law, right?
Yes. Yes, among other things. They were like the city administrators, the administrators right. of the kingdom. Kept the genealogical records and things like that.
I just met a new friend named Damian Lewis, and he's Welsh. He's a chef. He's contracts on boats, but smart guy.
Yeah, Lewis is actually a popular name among the Welsh.
Yeah.
It's not a coincidence.
No, I don't think so either.
Well, I love this bit, how the Pharisees question him, like they're the boss. For what reason does your teacher sit and eat with wrongdoers, right? And then Yahshua responds to them, and at the end he tells them, now going, you learn why it is mercy I desire, not sacrifice. So he tells them, you learn. I love that bit.
The funny thing is that if you read Josephus, the high priest at this time are sending out their officers to the Levites in the countryside and depriving them of their tithes and bringing them back to the temple to line their own pockets with.
That's what Jews do.
But it's okay when the government does it.
This old government. And then here's another spot where.
Go ahead, Joe.
Well, here's another spot where Christ refers to himself as the bridegroom. So that also tells us that he's the husband come in the flesh, because there can't be two bridegrooms, and he's going to die on the cross to release his wife on the law. Release his wife from the law as a husband does. When she dies, the wife is released from the law, as Paul says at Romans 7. So here's another spot where Christ is saying that he is the husband of Israel. He's the bridegroom. And they shall fast.
I'm still on tax collectors. But yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right. This is where he says the sons of the bride chamber. He's announcing that he's Yahweh come to marry Israel to himself. He's announcing that. There is no other context that could fit, but for those prophecies in Hosea, where Yahweh promises Israel, the children of Israel, that he was going to betroth them unto him forever.
And when he said that, they probably didn't have any context, right? It was only in retrospect that they realized what he meant.
Right.
I mean, just like today, right? If you talk to Judeos, you tell them about how many places in the Bible he refers to himself as the bridegroom, Israel as his wife, and so forth, it just glosses right over them. They don't.
Right. But our understanding of passages like this is why we are identity Christians.
Yeah. That's a very frustrating part, though, because I mean, you could just do a search on like Bible Gateway and see how often it appears, right? But they don't do that. Or whatever site.
They'll just say spiritual Israel.
Yeah, or something stupid like that.
As if God's, you know, an adulterer that marries multiple wives.
Yeah.
For some reason, you know.
Millions.
Get lost.
Millions.
Well, we're all the same, right?
And they're men and women too.
Well, that's projection, because that's where we behave as a group, right? So we just project it on him. I mean, really, as a group, right? Like, we're all basically whores, I mean, men and women.
Yeah. Yeah, so if he's a bridegroom, that means that this new covenant is according to that relationship. So the idea that universalism is just wrong on so many levels, because the idea that God's just going to invite all people to be his wife. No, it's based on the old relationship. And here you see new wine in, you know, a new, an old garment, you know, lifts its body. You know, we won't, this new covenant is what he's talking about here with this new wine, isn't it, Bill?
I'm sorry.
Because he has this new wine is the new covenant, isn't it? Because it's a new teaching, and they're trying to hold him to the old law or the old teachings. But he's saying, well, that teaching, that's done. We've got a new covenant now. And this is how the new covenant comes in, is with the husband dying on the cross. Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't word that. I didn't phrase that very well. I'll try.
I think I know what you mean.
Yeah, he tells you he's going to die too in that exchange.
Yeah, exactly. Because he says while the bridegroom is with them, but once he's taken away from them, then they shall fast. Yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't say depart. He says when he's taken away from them. Taken from them.
Yeah, against his will. But it is his will, ultimately.
I'm trying to get a better grip on this uncarded. Uncarded. It's not new cloth. It's different. It's cloth that hasn't been processed in some way yet that makes it fit for patching a garment with. I'm not sure of. I'm not a tailor, right? I don't do cloth, so I'm not
perhaps
really
like
that familiar with the language.
Part of raw material used to make a gar, like textile or something, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's washed, and then they do other stuff with it to make it worthy of being used in garments. And that's the meaning of the Greek here, is an uncarded piece of cloth. So I'm not sure exactly what that means, but in the new North American Standard Bible, they have unshrunk piece of cloth. But it's not a new cloth. It doesn't mean that in Greek. I mean, it might suggest the fact that the cloth is new because it's uncarded. Do you know what I mean? But, and it does say upon an old garment. So it's the opposite of old garment. But I think there's something a little more there in that process that I don't understand, but I just translated the passage literally. So that's why I have uncarded. But the meaning is clear. Yeah, you're not taking your new teachings and putting them atop of the teachings that these people have had. It's not necessarily Moses he's talking about. It's the teachings that these people have had that are half wrong, and he's not going to intermingle what he has to say with them, is the way I read that. He's not going to confound his teaching with the teachings of the Pharisees and the, because they're wrong.
Well, I mean, Jeff brought it up earlier. It seemed like a lot of people didn't have any understanding of Moses.
Well, no, because they've been learning from these Pharisees, from these Pharisees and Sadducees, that they've been learning from them. So they didn't understand Moses. And there's other indications of that in the gospel. A new teaching I teach to you, where Christ told his apostles in John that he was giving them a new commandment, thou shalt love one another. Well, it's not really a new commandment because it's in Leviticus chapter 19. But it must have been new to them because they weren't being taught Leviticus chapter 19.
Yeah, that
they were being taught some kind of proto-Mishnah or something.
Yeah, some Talmud and Torah.
Yeah, it's like Christ is the Messiah and he's teaching CI, and the people have always been taught some sort of universalist garbage, and so they can't see the truth of Moses or anything like that. I think Paul was teaching CI too, and he said without the gospel of Christ, there's a veil over the Old Testament. So people didn't understand the Old Testament, but then with CI, the gospel of Christ, you can see the truth of the Old Testament. The veil is lifted. Because it's
absolutely
true that Paul and Christ were both teaching what we call CI, but it's basically just the true gospel of Christ, which is covenant theology, which is the racial truth of the gospel, that he came to redeem those who are under the law.
Absolutely. Oh, okay, here's the exposition, right? John 13, 34. A new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another as I have loved you, and that you also love one another. And he called it a new commandment, and he's not lying. But in Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18, thou shalt not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people, but thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. I am Yahweh. So his commandment's not really new to Moses, but it's new to them. Because obviously the Pharisees weren't teaching it in their synagogues at this time. They weren't teaching Moses.
Yep. There's a veil over it, and the truth is revealed in Christ.
And today,
so John in 1 John chapter 2, verse 7 says, brethren, I write no new commandment unto you, but an old commandment which you had from the beginning. Which seems like John saying, hey, these things have been around forever. You just ain't heard them.
Yeah. You see something, Ram?
I was just saying, then we have a nigger living beside us that we think he's our neighbor.
Yeah, but in that passage in Leviticus, neighbor's defined as one of the children of thy people. And no nigger is the children of thy people.
Right, exactly.
We can go on a bit.
Upon his speaking these things to them, behold, one leader having come worshipped him, saying that my daughter has just now died. But coming, put your hands upon her, and she shall live. And arising, Yahshua followed him and his students. And behold, a woman having a flow of blood for 12 years approaching from behind, grabbed the hem of his garment. For she had said within herself, if only I may grab his garment, I shall be saved. Then Yahshua, turning and seeing her, said, have courage, daughter, your faith has saved you. And the woman had been saved from that hour. And upon Yahshua's having come to the house of the leader and seeing the flute players and the disturbed multitude, he said, withdraw, for the child has not died, but sleeps. And they derided him. But when he had cast out the crowd, entering in, he held her hand and raised the child. And the report of her went out into the whole land. And Yahshua passing from there, two blind men followed him, crying out and saying, have mercy on us, son of David. And upon having come into the house of the blind man, approached him, and Yahshua says to them, do you believe that I am able to do this? They say to him, yes, prince. Then he touched their eyes, saying, it must be for you according to your faith. And their eyes were opened, and Yahshua admonished them, saying, you must see that no one knows. But having departed, made it known in all the land. Then upon their departing, behold, they brought to him a mute man possessed by a demon, And upon the demons having been cast out, the mute spoke, and the crowds marveled, saying, never yet has such been seen in Israel. But the Pharisees said, by the prince of demons he casts out demons. And Yahshua went around all the cities and villages, teaching in their assembly halls and proclaiming the good message of the kingdom and healing every disease and every weakness. But seeing the crowds, he had been deeply moved on account of them, because they were troubled and downcast, just as sheep not having a shepherd. Then he says to his students, great is the harvest, but the workers are few. Therefore, it is necessary for the Lord of the harvest that he send out workers into the into his harvest.
Sheep not having a shepherd, because the Pharisees and the Sadducees were political and political rulers and political opportunists. They weren't shepherding the sheep. They weren't teaching the people the things they should have been teaching them. They were just opportunists. They were drifting, living off them. I'm sorry?
Some of them were wolves.
Oh, yeah, many of them were wolves, I'm sure. This woman having a flow of blood in 12 years. And Luke, there's a much longer version of this. But she came behind him and touched the border of his garment, and immediately her issue of blood stanched. This is Luke chapter 8. And Yahshua said, who touched me? I'm kind of reading the King James. When all denied, Peter and they that were with him said, Master, the multitude throngs thee and presses thee, and you say, who touched me? And Yahshua said, somebody has touched me, for I perceive that virtue or power has gone out of me. And when the woman saw that she was not hid, she came trembling and falling down before him, and she declared to him before all the people for what cause she had touched him, and how she was healed immediately. So that's a longer version from Luke's perspective, or from the perspective of his witness. Where here in Matthew, we have a shorter version, but that to me helps establish that the gospel is true, that these accounts weren't just copied from some source. That's bullshit. That's a Jewish lie. Matthew and Mark are similar in many ways, but it could very well be that Peter was the source of the early chapters of Matthew's gospel. And we know from the early church writers that Peter was the source of the entire gospel of Mark. So that could be very legitimate reasons why we have these differences and similarities in the four gospel accounts. And then you have the matter of perspective, where perhaps Luke's witness wasn't close enough, or Luke's witness was closer to Christ than Matthew was at this time. So he received a more detailed account than Matthew had. There's all kinds of reasons why these accounts may differ in areas and are so similar in areas. And they're legitimate reasons. They're very likely legitimate reasons. They're not what the Jewish critics think they are.
He would have known who touched his garment too, but to make an example, he got her to admit it, and then she's trembling. I think that's really great. She's trembling, and then he has mercy on her.
Yep.
Right. He didn't want to make her feel like she did something wrong, right?
Yeah, because, yeah, she did it, like, sneakily, and then he makes an example and says, you know, your faith has saved you.
But does that show us that even when we don't think God is listening, that our prayers could still be answered? That's what I would get out of that. Even when we don't think he's listening, our prayers still can be answered.
Well, I think that's in Samuel. I can't remember the name of the lady. where she wasn't speaking, but he heard her anyway?
Yes. Yes, that was the mother of Samson, I yes. believe. No, that was the mother of Samuel.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, okay.
He touched their eyes, saying, "It must be according for you, according to your faith, healing these blind guys. It must be for you, according to your faith." That's pretty much a challenge from God, right? If you don't believe me, you can just stay blind. I don't care.
Hey, Bill. So when he's done this before, he did this often. He kept telling people, "Don't say anything," but he knew they were going to say anything. Like that's in 30 and 31.
Right.
Why do you think he did that?
Well, it seems to me that it's an expression of humility. You must see that no one knows. Don't tell anybody I did this for you. He's saying that he doesn't need to be famous. That he doesn't want this trumpeted.
Yeah,
in worldly terms.
Yeah.
He's able to do this for people, but he doesn't want them to run around announcing it, like giving him any credit for it. It's an example. When you do something good for someone, you don't want to trumpet it abroad.
Okay, so it's an example for us, yeah.
That's how I see it.
I mean,
that's how I see all of his actions are basically an example for us.
But he knows we're going to do it anyway, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's happened a bunch in the Gospels. The blind man in John chapter 9 being one of them.
In his own land, isn't there a thing where he couldn't do many works of power there because the people didn't believe in him? And so if he'd actually healed people there, they wouldn't attribute it to God anyways. So it wouldn't have been righteous, you know what I mean? If he healed random people who had no faith, how does that help for the kingdom of God? And people who don't have any faith, they should actually suffer their sins until they repent, you know what I mean? So that's why it must be for you according to your faith. It's righteous and just, it seems to me.
Yeah, he said that a prophet is not without honor except in his own fatherland, except in his own land. I mean, that's people. Yeah, you could be that little kid Joe that everybody knew, that all your relatives know, and you're Joe, the little kid that always did this or that or whatever. Got himself in trouble, right? It's like whatever you did when you were young, and when you grow up into a wise, full grown man that has some sort of knowledge, they're gonna say, "Oh, that's just Joe." Yeah, you know what? They're gonna despise you because they have intimate knowledge of you and they've known you all your life.
Yeah, they remember when you stole that apple at the food store or whatever.
Yeah, they'll remember all those stupid little things you were doing when you were a kid. Is this not Jesus, the son of the carpenter, and his mother and his brothers and his sisters are with us to this day? In other words, they despise him because they were so familiar with him. They were intimately familiar with him, so they thought they knew him. And they really didn't.
So you could be a stranger in your own land, I guess.
Yeah, right. You can't teach your elders and the people in your community that knew you as a child, and they're always going to look down on you as a child. They're not going to want to believe that you could learn more than them, right? And teach them when you were that little fucking brat that used to steal the fruit off their front doorstep in the mornings or something, whatever.
It's funny how the Pharisees think that by the prince of demons, he casts out demons. Well, under their watch, the people were all possessed and afflicted by demons. And then Yahshua comes and frees them from these demons. And their response is to say, by the prince of demons, he casts out. It's so dumb.
They're gaslighting them. They're blaming it on him.
They're envious. They think they have some authority
by their
from
fruits.
God, but they don't.
Well, at least they recognize that demons exist. But I know what you mean.
Bill, yeah. Do you have a paper on demons? I've never checked, and I guess I could look it up. But
yeah, you know, I've talked about the meanings of the words, the technical aspects.
I've heard it in a few podcasts, and
in both the Old and New Testaments, right? The sheds and the things like that. But no, I've never written a paper just about demons.
Yeah, probably not worthwhile, really, is it?
I'm sorry?
It's probably not worthwhile to write a paper about it, really, is it?
I can't imagine. Simply because of a total lack of experience on my part. I mean, I know plenty of two-legged demons.
there's millions and millions and millions of them.
I know plenty of embodied demons my whole life.
Billion in Africa.
Well, that's
billion aid in China.
Part of, so when I first started listening to your podcast, I really liked it because you said it here and there, I can't remember exactly where, which is that demons are disembodied devils. And non-whites are embodied devils. And I knew right away it was true. That was actually, I think, one of the first things I ever heard from you. And I knew it was true. It's a great description. I'm not trying to kiss your ass, but it's a great description.
I think he mentioned in the Genesis 10 commentary as well. Or it was part 10.
Yeah, okay.
It's all through your work, though, Bill. Like I've read parts where you discuss the demons in the Old Testament, the shades. And then especially when you discuss how John says, try every spirit to see whether they're from God, because obviously there's disembodied spirits that aren't from God.
Right.
So you discuss that. So
it's all true. Disembodied spirits that aren't from God.
Yeah. Where'd they come from? Where'd these bad fish come from? God didn't make any bad. Why would God make bad fish? Why would God make a nigger or a Jew? What purpose do they have in nature?
Well, we know why he keeps them around, but you're right. He would not create them, I think. That scripture tells us that.
Yeah, they are a corruption of his creation.
Yahweh God is not a stick for creating death. He's sadistic for creating niggers and Jews. Now we're blaming him for the sin of men and angels, right?
Yeah, it's just part of our punishment and part of the lesson, right? So they're around to almost, well, torment us, but it's not his fault. It's our fault.
Yeah, I mean, it's our ancestors that contributed to enable them to be here. Or actually helping them here. Sexual sort of way.
Some people want the demons around. Some people want demons to enter the congregation of God. But that's a betrayal of our brethren and a betrayal of God, because just having them around puts the whole congregation at risk of being mongrelized. And then how are they the people of God? So you want to be nice to demons? Well, though, being nice to demons just leads us down the path to hell. And this,
you know, I was with Melissa and Brad about 2 weeks ago, Florida, and we stopped at this restaurant that we hated. We're never going to go back to it. And there were two Mexicans working there. And they weren't as tall as I am if one of them was standing on the other's shoulders. They were both like 3 feet tall, man. And Melissa and Brett are marveling at them and like, yeah, that's how they really are. That's how the Mexicans are in Mexico, that the aboriginal Mexican Indians, that's what they're like. I saw them all the time in prison. 3.5, 4 foot tall Mexicans with big heads.
Squatting.
I saw them all the time in prison.
Bill, you said they don't even know how to use a toilet, do they? They stand on the toilet, right?
Yeah.
They squat over it.
These Mexicans, they're not really Mexicans. They're some kind of aboriginal Indians from Mexico. But to create Mexicans, people came over from Europe and cohabited with them to create Mexicans. And it's like, what kind of people from Europe? Jews, right? Jews, for the most part, I bet.
Yes.
Arabs.
Yeah. Guzman is a Jewish name. Yeah. Joaquin is a Jewish name. El Chapo is a kike.
Yeah. They're the only ones that would ever want to interbreed with a bunch of dwarfed primitive.
Well, yeah. I couldn't imagine a white guy would go to Mexico from Spain and sleep with these 3 foot tall munchkins. I'm sure some did, though.
Well, the Jews would love them because they remind them of kids.
Yeah. Yeah, the demons going into the swine.
Yes.
As I get older, the demon comes out more and more. So some white men will marry this this Hispanic girl and he thinks she's real pretty. And then 10 years later, she looks like a demon and she looks like her mother. And it's just horrible. People don't realize that as these demons age, the demon comes out more and more. And you get to the end of your life and you've married this thing.
Yeah. Man. They age like milk.
They all look like dogs too. Even the quote unquote pretty ones. They literally look like canines.
Yeah, they actually look like
dog people, pretty dog people.
About. You're in Florida here. They look like, if anybody's seen Star Wars, they look like the co-pilot of the Millennium Falcon.
Well, I'll give you an example, right? Sorry, Riff. No, but just, sometimes there are like ladies that are like 70 or 80, right? But you can tell, she's still pretty, right? Like she's a pretty lady.
Yeah.
That never happens with the other races. No. Yeah.
Never, not without a lot of surgery, and then they all look like alien Jews. Have you noticed that too? The facelift, yeah. They all look like alien Jews, all of them.
That's my point. They look like aliens.
I don't think they're pretty. I'm just saying that some white men think they're pretty when they're young. That's not me.
No, I know.
Why don't they think white women are pretty? And yeah, it's true. When white women get older, you look at them and she was attractive when she was young.
Yeah.
We had
but never with the non-whites.
We had one down here, he's about 4 foot tall. He sued the city and won the damn lawsuit.
What is it regarding?
What? Because he couldn't get on the roller coaster?
No, they built the sidewalk too close to his ass.
Okay, I'm going to cut this unless you guys want me not to.
No, we're good, David. Thank you.
Good. Okay.